Hi again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's, and I'm joined by the center's other co-director, Mark DiGirolami, for another episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on issues and cases in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived at lawandreligionforum.org and also on iTunes. Well, Mark, this is going to be our last episode for the calendar year, and we're going to consider in this episode a new religion case that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear. The case is called Tanzin versus Tanvir. The court granted cert in the case last month, which, if I'm right, makes it the second law and religion case that the court has agreed to hear this term. The other one is Espinoza, which we've already talked about. This case, Tanzin, involves a narrow question. It's a narrow question of statutory interpretation involving a statute called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA. And the question is whether RFRA gives plaintiffs a right to sue government officials for money damages in their individual capacities, not their official capacities, so money that comes out of the officials' own pockets. Now, as Judge Cabranes wrote in a dissent in the case below, answering that question requires a lot of heavy lifting. It requires not only a close reading of the statute and the legislative history, but also knowledge of some pretty complicated doctrines in federal courts law. So it's fair to say, Mark, this is maybe not as gripping a question as some of the others that we've discussed, but it's still an important one.
No, I think that's right. And it's not as sort of much fun historically as the Blaine Amendment case that we've talked about, or some of the hotter issues concerning abortion or same-sex marriage and so on. So we'll try to give it a little bit of spice so as not to discourage listeners from continuing to listen, which you absolutely should after we talk about the specifics of the case.
Right. And the reason it's important, practically speaking, and I think this explains why the court took the case, is even though it's a little bit obscure, it's practically very important. As the SG's office argued in the cert petition, if government officials are personally liable out of their own pockets for damages in RFRA cases, well, that could create serious obstacles to the execution of government programs, including in the national security context, which is where this case comes up. Government programs often require that officials make judgment calls. And if officials fear that they will be personally liable if they make mistakes, then the officials may err too much on the side of caution and be inappropriately defensive in doing their jobs.
But if you flip the issue around, if government officials are personally liable when they violate a statute like RFRA, then that's going to be a powerful tool for preventing violations of religious freedoms. Why? Well, because government officials of all kinds, not just in the national security context, but you think about government officials in universities, for example, they will think twice about violating a plaintiff's rights if they know that they themselves and their own pocketbooks are going to be on the line, and that could be a good thing with respect to enforcement of some of these civil rights laws.
Right, so it's a nice question as a practical matter whether the benefits would outweigh the costs here. Now, everyone agrees that that decision, whether the benefits outweigh the costs, that's a decision for Congress to make. But if Congress isn't explicit in a statute, then what should the rule be? Right? There are serious practical consequences either way, so how should courts make the call? And that's really the big issue that's involved in this case. Well, as a roadmap for our podcast, what we're first going to do is describe this case, then we'll talk about the arguments in the cert petition, and then we'll have some thoughts on this bigger issue, the practical issue in the case. Okay, Mark, so why don't you begin by telling us about this case?
Okay, great. So plaintiffs are Muslims and American citizens who say that federal law enforcement agents place them, the plaintiffs, on the so-called no-fly list when they refuse to serve as FBI informants in the Muslim community. And so plaintiffs say they objected to serving as informants because of their religious convictions as Muslims, and that, they say, implicates their rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. We've talked a lot about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act before, right, Mark?
Yes. So we have it's very important in this area. The Act says that the government cannot substantially burden a person's religious exercise unless the government has a compelling interest for doing so and has chosen the least restrictive means of doing so. Now, we should say the substance of the plaintiff's claim is not what's at issue in this cert petition.
So the issue about whether what the government did actually violated RFRA.
That's not a question, right? The question here is the following. The plaintiffs sued the federal agents, the ones they allege violated their rights, in the agents' individual capacities, seeking compensatory and punitive damages under RFRA. The district court ruled that RFRA did not allow government officials to be sued for money damages in their personal capacities, and the plaintiffs appealed that. And that's the narrow question at issue here in this interlocutory appeal. Whether the federal officials actually violated RFRA, that remains to be determined at a later date. Okay, so the district court said that this is not possible. You can't sue federal agents in their individual capacities. A Second Circuit panel reversed the district court.
Right. It said that RFRA does allow actions against officials for money damages in their individual capacities. The panel said RFRA says that any, quote, person whose religious exercise has been burdened in violation of the statute, close quote, can assert that violation as a claim in a judicial proceeding and obtain appropriate relief against a government.
Right, appropriate relief. Okay, so now the RFRA goes on to define government as a branch, department, agency, instrumentality, and official of the United States. So in this case, the Second Circuit panel held that this statutory language meant that the plaintiffs could sue government officials in their individual capacities, not simply in their official capacities.
By the way, Mark, it's not at all clear to me that that language on its own has that implication.
Well, we're going to get to the...
Just because you say and official doesn't mean that and official can be sued in his individual capacity.
That's correct, and that was one of the issues on rehearing that we'll get to. But so not only can the plaintiff sue government officials in their individual capacities, but also appropriate relief against the government in the language of the statute includes money damages that the officials must pay out of their own pockets. Now, this is a complicated statutory argument.
You know, it reminds me, Mark, a little bit of the argument in Hobby Lobby about whether person includes corporation, except it's perhaps slightly, maybe even more recondite and difficult. But it was, if you remember in the Hobby Lobby case, that was the initial threshold argument before getting to the merits, that the plaintiffs had to argue these sort of intricate arguments about statutory interpretation. What does person mean? Does person include? And then you go back to the Dictionary Act and all that stuff, right?
So you're right. In that sense, it is like Hobby Lobby in that we're getting into complicated issues of definition under the statute. The case also touches on some complicated Fed courts doctrines like the Bivens line of cases, which involve implied rights of action for certain constitutional violations. We're not going to go into the details of Bivens' actions in this podcast, but I want to give a couple of highlights in the court's opinion, the panel's opinion. The panel said, look, the plain text, the panel disagreed with Professor DiGirolami, the panel said, the plain text of the statute gives the right to sue officials as individuals. RFRA was meant to be sweeping, a sweeping statute. There's also similar language in other statutes, like Section 1983, the panel said, which allows suits against individual officers for violating constitutional rights. Moreover, the panel said, this reference in RFRA to appropriate remedy, remember the statute says that the official can be sued and the plaintiff can obtain appropriate relief. Okay, well, appropriate relief is a bit ambiguous, the panel said, but there are background legal norms that indicate that in this context, money damages are appropriate because we have to, quote, make good the wrong done.
Okay, good. And the panel also distinguished a case that the Supreme Court decided called Sossamon, and that case involved the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, also called RLUIPA, where the Supreme Court said that similar, quote-unquote, appropriate remedy language in that statute, in RLUIPA, a narrower statute, did not allow for money damages against officers sued in their individual capacity.
Right, and the panel said, and here I'm getting Fed Courts flashbacks from my third year of law school. The panel said, well, that case, the Sossamon case involving RLUIPA, is different, even though the language in the two statutes is the same, because that case presented questions of state sovereign immunity.
So let me
get this
straight.
Which, by the way, for those of you who have not taken Fed Courts, state sovereign immunity is one of the most recondite doctrines in Fed Courts. Whenever you see that, it's time to go running.
So a narrower statute in terms of scope is one, according to the panel, that has greater limitations on suits against officials in their individual capacities than a statute that has far broader applications. Is that about right, Mark?
Because of state sovereign immunity concerns, which are not present in RFRA, which, of course, doesn't apply to the states after the Bernie case. Anyway, that was what the panel said. The panel didn't address another claim of qualified immunity, which certainly would come up here for the officers because it was just premature. Okay, that was the panel decision, and you can tell, listeners, that Professor DiGirolami is quite skeptical about this.
Look, it's not my area, frankly. Statutory interpretation is not something that I do a lot of, but it seems like there are at least some tensions in the panel's opinion.
Right.
Well, what do you think, Mark?
Well, I'm going to be agnostic about this issue for the time being. I'm here, listeners, just to give an objective view of the case. Well, we'll talk later about what I think about the policy implications here. Okay, so the Second Circuit denied rehearing in bank of this panel decision, but there were a couple of very strong dissents, one written by Judge Dennis Jacobs and the other written by Judge Jose Capranas. So, Mark, why don't we talk first about Judge Jacobs's dissent?
Okay, so Judge Jacobs says, look, this is a concerning decision for federal officers who are now going to act defensively in the pursuit of their duties. They're going to act in fear that they will be individually sued. And Jacobs took a little shot against judges and law clerks who obviously don't have to fear anything. Well, they're perfectly happy, judges and law clerks, to write opinions like this in the comfort knowing that they're not going to be individually sued, but not people that enforce these policies, apparently.
Right, and not only individually sued, but they're going to have to pay the money out of their own pockets. And
right.
So you wonder, are they going to have to buy insurance policies? If you sign up to be a TSA agent, do you have to, or an FBI agent, do you have to now purchase insurance? I imagine that would be prohibitively expensive.
Yeah, law clerk insurance.
Law clerks are, Judge Jacobs does point this out, that judges and law clerks don't have to worry about getting sued if they make a mistake.
Right,
but, you know, the FBI agent apparently will now.
Okay, so in addition, Judge Jacobs rejects the panel's attempt to distinguish Sossamon, which was the RLUIPA case that I mentioned.
So he's with you.
He's making these similar sorts of points, that personal liability for government officials is very unusual, that courts shouldn't impose it without really an explicit authorization from Congress, that the Supreme Court has indicated that Bivens actions really are not available for the Free Exercise Clause, so allowing a private right of action against individual officers under RFRA would be a kind of way for the Second Circuit to circumvent what the Supreme Court has said about these so-called Bivens actions.
Right, and I want to just bring us back to the point I made in the beginning. So everyone agrees that this is a decision for Congress to make. If Congress decides that individual officers are liable personally for violations of the statute, then Congress can certainly do that. The question is, when the language is ambiguous, as it is in this case, as even the panel agreed was the situation here, then how should the courts determine this? And what Judge Jacobs is saying is, look, this is so unusual. It's so unusual to say that a federal officer is personally liable for something like this that we just can't assume that Congress would do that without being very explicit about it.
I want to note one other thing that Judge Jacobs says, which is that RFRA was not supposed to change Free Exercise Clause law, but only return it to the way that it was before Smith. That actually is an argument that, again, one heard in the Hobby Lobby litigation, right, where there was a claim that one side said, no, RFRA actually expanded the law of free exercise with respect to religious exemptions, while the other side said, no, what RFRA was intended to do, and again, a question of congressional intent, was to return the law to the substantial burden, compelling interest approach before Smith, which approach in this case clearly did not contemplate individual officer liability under a free exercise clause claim.
Right. Okay. So that was Judge Jacobs's dissent from rehearing. There was another dissent from rehearing by Judge Jose Capranas, and he was actually similar to Judge Jacobs, but I think even more pointed. Judge Capranas basically says the panel is just being irresponsible here, that there's no way to understand RFRA as expressing a congressional intent to have these sort of damages individually against federal officers. And Capranas says, look, the panel is just willfully disregarding the precedent here. I suppose we should say, by the way, that our center board member, Judge Richard Sullivan, joined both of these dissents, but we have not discussed this with him at all.
Good. All right. So that's the case. As we've said, it's not the most exciting of cases. It's got a lot of technical statutory interpretation issues. It probably won't generate that many headlines. I mean, law and religion cases often do generate headlines. This one might generate its fair share, but probably not as much as some of the more controversial hot-button questions.
Right, but it's still very important. And in fact, even though it's not immediately accessible to the public the way some of these other cases are, some people have picked up the importance of this case, which, as I've said now a couple times, has to do with the practical consequences. I mean, we have to balance the worry that federal agents who are personally liable will be inappropriately defensive in doing their jobs because they don't want to get sued and they certainly don't want to have to pay out of their own pockets. And after all, these are not wealthy people with lots of money to pay, right? You have to balance that against the concern that, well, it's otherwise too easy for the government to violate religious freedom. And this is the kind of balance that needs to be struck.
Yeah, that's right. And even for a case that doesn't immediately or on the surface of it implicate deeper sort of culture war questions, one can think about, and I think some writers have started to think about, the underlying sort of cultural cross currents in play that the case does implicate.
Right. It's a nice lesson for us, which is these law and religion cases, even if they seem kind of technical on the surface, in fact, there often are culture war implications here.
Right. So in Vox a few weeks ago, for example, Ian Millhiser, who's a journalist who writes about legal issues, wrote that while the facts of the case, quote, inspire a great deal of sympathy among liberals, close quote, because the case concerns an American Muslim, the case was actually dangerous for progressives.
And what's dangerous about this case for progressives, according to Millhiser?
Well, what he says is, quote, another story, close quote, can be told about the case, a story that is kind of lurking in the background of the actual facts, because the, quote unquote, biggest winner to emerge from a holding that individual officers can be sued under RFRA would be, according to Millhiser, the Christian right. And here Millhiser raises Hobby Lobby, the Hobby Lobby case, as well as the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. Now, we should emphasize that while Hobby Lobby might be implicated in this case, or by the holding of this case,
because Hobby Lobby involved RFRA.
Because Hobby Lobby involved RFRA, Masterpiece Cake Shop would not. Masterpiece Cake Shop was a case concerning a Colorado civil rights statute, so that kind of statute wouldn't be implicated by an interpretation that the court gave of a federal statute, RFRA. But I understand the general argument. The general argument is sort of the same.
But I'm not familiar with all the state RFRAs in detail. I mean, they're quite varied. I imagine some of the state RFRAs might have language like this.
They might, but that would require a different decision interpreting those statutes. But at any rate, the point that Millhiser was making was, look, how much more powerful are these claims going to become if, for example, Jack Phillips, the Christian baker in Masterpiece Cake Shop, could sue the members of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission directly and make them pay for any violation of his civil rights? Or how much more powerful would a claimant like Hobby Lobby be if it could bring claims directly against individual officers enforcing RFRA and force them to pay any damages?
So, I mean, Millhiser's point, as you're describing it, Mark, might be recapitulated as follows, that, well, this would be a great opinion if it were limited only to the victims of religious discrimination that we progressives like, but since it might help the victims of religious discrimination whom we don't particularly care for, we have to be careful. Is that about right?
I think that's right. And I think,
which is interesting because, you know, up until, I would say, the last 10 years or so, religious freedom was really a bipartisan thing. Nobody thought that religious freedom had partisan implications, or we'll support it when it helps the people we like, but we're not going to support it when it helps people we don't like.
Well, I have to say it was bracing to see the point stated so clearly in the piece. And I do think it's true that over the last 10 years, religious conservatives have been bringing more of these kinds of claims that have been adjudicated in the Supreme Court. And so people who are not sympathetic to religious conservatives are probably watching that closely and watching what the implications of a case like this that concerns Muslim Americans, a constituency as to which I guess progressives are more naturally inclined, in Millhiser's view, would affect this other class of cases.
Now, to be fair, I'm sure that our progressive friends would say, well, in the old days when religious conservatives were not the ones bringing these claims, probably religious conservatives weren't that enamored of religious freedom claims either.
I think that's probably true, and one could even describe Employment Division versus Smith.
That's what I'm thinking of.
As an example where a conservative court, politically conservative court majority, would have held against the Native Americans bringing that claim. So I think it's in some ways it's inescapable that one's politics and one's religious commitments, one's religious and political theology sort of creep into how one feels about some of these technical problems.
Right. So in other words, this case, even though, as I've said, on the surface, it seems like it's just a narrow statutory interpretation question, in fact, there are a lot of ramifications for broader social and cultural issues.
I think that's right.
Okay. Well, thanks, everyone. That'll be our last episode for the calendar year. We want to wish a Merry Christmas to everyone who celebrates, a Happy Holidays to everyone, and a Happy New Year. And we will see you next time. Until then, this has been Mark Movsesian and Mark DiGirolami, the co-directors of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's, with another episode of Legal Spirits.